welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is June 3rd, 2026, and this is episode 611. I am the co-host Mark Ames out in the western portion of the grand state of New York. You're listening to Radio War Nerd. Support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio War Nerd and smash that subscribe button, as they say, even though you don't smash it in Patreon. And I'm on the line, of course, with the War Nerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Britcher in southern Italy. How are you doing today, John?
I'm a lot better, really. Like, there's probably a point at which dirt bike noises become just background, but you have to go through hours of torture because all the dirt bikers were out for the Italian, basically Independence Day celebrations when to commemorate Italy having voted for a new constitution after the Second World War and kicking out their largely useless monarchy. Mm-hmm. So everybody decided to, What do you call
cruising,
really?
I guess. Cruising, yeah. So it was just an excuse to cruise and show off their motorbikes and be loud. Yeah, there
loud
are people
as
who
hell.
Just like to be loud. Yeah, I heard that when we had you in the background yesterday. So good. Quiet at last.
So today we are
very honored to have with us great guest, someone that I've been following since I discovered her. One of those rare good things on social media. There's, we talk all the time about what a hellscape social media and especially Twitter X is. But sometimes, especially in wars or in crises, you do come across very useful and smart and helpful voices and writers and thinkers and analysts. And our guest today, Mariam Jamshidi, is one such and is an expert on international law and issues like territorial waters. Mariam Jamshidi is an associate professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School, and she also has a new Substack. We'll be discussing two of her articles on them called Anti-Imperium. We'll definitely post links. And also had a recent article in The Nation on this subject of what rights does Iran have over the all-important Strait of Hormuz or not. So we'll post a link to her article in The Nation as well. But first of all, Mariam, thanks for coming on Radio War Nerd.
Thank you so much for having me on and being interested in this like incredibly wonky, somewhat technically annoying area of the law.
We're gonna have a glossary of terms here.
Oh,
but
God, yes.
I think our subscribers will appreciate this because you always know there's, for example, when the U.S. and its allies start suddenly crying about international law and Iran violating international law over a toll after they just launched an illegal war of aggression and illegally assassinated heads of state. You know something, we're not being told something, here.
Right,
something's up and not many people have the time or really willing to get into the weeds of this thing because it is law and it is dry. Mm. But we have a lot of, the show has the word nerd in it. So we do like to nerd out on things. But before we get into that, to set this, I think we should briefly just kind of mention some of the events of the past 24 hours in that region. People might have seen in newspapers or online, on social media, some of the photos coming out of Kuwait because the Kuwait International Airport, the passenger terminal, was hit very hard by the IRI. And the events of the past 24 hours, as I understand them, go something like this. Earlier yesterday, the U.S. fired a Hellfire missile at an Iranian oil tanker, the Leon Star, in the Gulf of Oman. So U.S. warships. I mean, there's been a lot. It's one of these things that's kind of shrouded in mystery, how much the U.S. Navy is actually traversing the Strait of Hormuz? Are they staying in this Gulf of Oman or really outside the Gulf of Oman? Because they are very vulnerable no matter what systems they have. But in any event, they did fire a Hellfire missile and disable this Iranian oil tanker, presumably in the Gulf of Oman. It's the fifth tanker that the U.S. has hit since the ceasefire. So Iran fired back. They hit a tanker just in an Iraqi port owned by the largest shipping company in the world, the Mediterranean Shipping Company. And I believe, I was reading somewhere that the head of this company is somebody very close to Trump. So it was meant to send a few messages. So the U.S., in as they said it in their statements, in self-defense, attacked Keshem Island, which is, and we'll discuss, which is in the Persian Gulf side of the Strait of Hormuz, depending on how you define this, how broad the Strait of Hormuz is defined. But in any event, it is Iranian territory, and it is in or partly in the Strait of Hormuz, just so that people can imagine it. And Iran responded by sending drones and missiles at both Bahrain and at the Fifth Fleet headquarters, the U.S. Fifth Fleet headquarters there. Supposedly, they were all shot down. We never know. We know we've been lied to a lot in the past about this. A lot more is coming out about how much damage Iranian drones and missiles have caused in U.S. bases in the Gulf. But also hitting Kuwait, attacking both the main U.S. air base there, but also Kuwait's airport. And there is some question over whether the damage to the airport, and by the way, one person was killed in the airport. I think it was an Indian national, and several were wounded, at least so far, that's what we've been told. But the images are pretty stark. I mean, this is a, you know, a serious airport in a wealthy country, and it's these are scary photos that would keep people from wanting to travel there for a while. So this affects Kuwait's, you know, economy in a serious way, on top of the fact that it still can't get its oil out. But the main message here, well, first of all, Iran then released, I think through, at least it was reported through, I think one of the Iranian media outlets, that Iran basically said, we're no longer doing this tit for tat, because Trump, while he still is, you know, he's just having the hardest time formalizing his capitulation. And he may get there and he may not get there. he probably prefers to stay in this limbo as long as he can, because formalizing the capitulation will be rough. And as part of that, the U.S. with Israel is trying to slowly turn up the heat. And, you know, Iran obviously knows our tricks. The Trump administration is not the slyest, brightest, you know, administration we've had. So the Iranians basically came out and said, we're no longer doing a kind of one-for-one, tit-for-tat. When you do this, we're going to hit much harder back, so that there's a real cost. And basically kind of reimposing escalation dominance, because Iran wants to preserve its status, its current status, which is victor. It won the war, and right now it hasn't been formalized, but it won the war, and it has this enormous power and domination or power or, you know, over the Strait of Hormuz, and therefore all of the oil products, fertilizers, everything that comes out of the Persian Gulf, and even out of part of the Gulf of Oman, it now is under some direct, you know, some control, some power from Iran that it didn't have before February 28th. And so this brings us to our subject today, which is the debate over what Iran's legal rights, or what it legally can do, or what you know, its rights to, I don't know, impose a toll. I think they've backed off that specific language. But what rights it has over those waters in the Strait of Hormuz. So I think in order to try to understand this, can we just first get a couple of definitions here to understand what we're talking about. So the Strait of Hormuz, as I understand it, is about 21 miles across at its shortest point, which is the shortest point would be from that little exclave, that Omani exclave at the tip of the southern part of the Strait of Hormuz. Between that and Iranian territories, like 21 miles. So tell us, I guess first, could you define for us territorial waters, contiguous waters, and if it's relevant here, exclusive economic zone, EEZs?
Sure. So the it's, again, so nice to be here. Let's let it rip. So the territorial sea of states is defined as 12 nautical miles beyond the baseline, basically the coastline of a state. Those are the territorial waters of a state. States have sovereignty, full sovereignty. I mean, not sovereign. I mean, there are some limitations, but, you know, as sovereign as they're going to be in the sort of seas, it's happening in their territorial waters, right? So where they have the greatest regulatory power, the greatest enforcement power, their territorial seas are sort of the apex of all of that. Now, 24 nautical miles out from the baseline is known as the contiguous zone for states. Within the contiguous zone, states have limited enforcement powers relating to either preventing or actually enforcing violations of certain kinds of laws, specifically customs, fiscal, immigration, and sanitary. So that's what you can do in your contiguous zone.
I'm sorry to stop 12, you here real quickly. Do all states agree with, did they have to sign any convention to agree to this? Or is this almost like a common law thing? Or how did this develop, these two, so before we get to easy?
So, I mean, how it developed, I mean, there were practices that were becoming more and more robust around the territorial seas, delimitation mark being 12 nautical miles, as well as the existence of a contiguous zone, for several years before they actually became codified in treaties. That codification moment makes, I think for most people, pretty clear that those principles that I just laid out for those two zones are now considered customary international law, which is basically common law. The territorial sea thing was probably common law even before it became memorialized in the UNCLOS Treaty, which is opened for signature in 1982. But the contiguous zone had been codified a little bit earlier. So yeah, those are very well-established principles and zones of the sea, as is the exclusive economic zone. So the exclusive economic zone is 200 nautical miles from the baseline of a state. And it's the most complex zone of all the maritime zones because there are sort of shared rights between the coastal state and foreign states that enter the exclusive economic zone. So at a very high level, basically, coastal states within 200 nautical miles, and as you're probably gathering, these zones overlap, right?
Yes,
so the exclusive economic zone basically includes the territorial sea and the contiguous zone, right? It's just that, like, the rights and obligations of states shift as the mile marks increase. So beyond the contiguous zone, where you have the full exclusive economic zone, right, the rest of it, what states can do there, coastal states can do there, is basically they have exclusive sovereign rights over, like, the economic development of the exclusive economic zone. So living resources, non-living resources in the soil, subsoil, in the seabed, in the water, you know, they have effectively, like, the economic exclusivity over those areas.
Over, like,
that area.
Fishing and deep sea oil drilling, sort of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember many years ago there was a lot of fear among powers that specialized in fishing over what this would mean to the future of fishing fleets.
Well, it's actually been really great for developed states. So developed states do actually really like the EEZ concept because they've been able to exploit their own EEZs, right, more fully right. as a result of this concept, right? So while it was actually really developed by third world countries over the course of several decades before it was finally memorialized in the UNCLOS treaty, mm-hmm. It ultimately is developed states that have really been able to exploit them more, their own EEZs more. And, you know, so, you know, the basic rules are that the coastal states have these sort of exclusive economic rights and then sovereign rights to these economic, the economic development of the EEZ. And they have jurisdiction over a couple of other things like creating, you know, artificial installations, or artificial islands within the economic zone. Also, they have sovereign rights over marine research as well as sort of the environmental management of the space. But, you know, they can enter into bilateral treaties or other treaties with other countries to give them more rights within their exclusive economic zones as well. So it's this kind of a dance between the sort of coastal states and the foreign states. The foreign states also have rights within the exclusive economic zones of other countries, which include, you know, to the extent, again, because it's this sort of tension between these two rights, to the extent that it doesn't violate the exclusive economic sovereignty of coastal states, you know, they have freedom of navigation, freedom of overflight, the right to lay submarine cables and pipelines. So, mm-hmm. you know, so right. The farther you get out from the coastline, the more the rights of the coastal states decrease and the rights of foreign states increase. And on the high seas, you know, it's kind of a free-for-all.
Right, right.
You know, no one's sovereign over the high seas.
Right. Just a quick sort of factoid here. This came up when John and I, one of our very early episodes, did an episode on China and mm-hmm. the U.S. and the South China Sea. We learned then, I had no idea, that France has the largest exclusive economic zone territory of any country in the world, because France has, in its colonial past, took so many Pacific islands and some Indian Ocean islands, and they aren't really contiguous with other states, a lot of them. So those 200-mile zones are all theirs. That really blew me away, you know, because you kind of think of France as a very, very post-colonial, you know, society. But yeah. So let's get back to the Strait of Hormuz here. So we're talking about this incredibly strategic, vital, as they say, waterway, 21 miles across at its shortest point, at its narrowest point. And Iran, since the war, has staked a claim that it's, I guess, could you lay out the kind of the debate here? Because on one side, let's say the U.S. and its allies side, their argument is that it's like the Strait of Malacca or Bosphorus or something. I don't know. One of these other straits where it's illegal for any country to impose any limits whatsoever on shipping. That's their basic argument. And Iran is saying, no, this is territorial waters and we are citing other law to justify our position, which is, and also they plan to charge maybe for environmental cleanup or patrolling or whatever, but really in order to help rebuild Iran after the U.S. and Israel caused so much damage there.
Right. So, you know, so the debate is very confusing because the way the actors talk about the relevant issues is not very clear. They often, I think, use the incorrect terms, and the terms actually matter a lot. So, you know, the Strait of Hormuz is an international strait. Like, there's no doubt about that. So is the Strait of Malacca. So is the Bosphorus, the Turkish Straits, the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus. These are all international straits. What law governs them is not necessarily the same. So the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles are actually subject to a relatively old treaty called the Montreux Convention, which sets out the regulatory regime, the rights of Turkey, all that kind of stuff for those straits. So that's a fully separate regime, not covered by UNCLOS or customary international law. It is subject to its own treaty. So that's the Bosphorus.
I'm sorry. So that means you can have carve-outs, I guess, or whatever you call
them. You can have carve-outs. Yeah. I mean, you can have treaties. So, like, you know, international law, you know, has sort of like a sort of common law as we were discussing, the sort of customary international law, it's also composed of treaties. Treaties are a way of actually like contracting around customary international law. You can think of them as statutes almost. Mm-hmm. So, you know, treaties can do things that are different from customary international law. And in particular, because the Bosporus and Dardanelles Treaty, the Montreux Convention, like predates, UNCLOS by decades.
Right, right.
You know, it has never been subject to that treaty. And UNCLOS actually has carve-outs for treaties that are
okay.
for certain international straits that are subject to other regimes. So yeah, the Bosporus is different. My understanding, and again, don't quote me on this, is that the Strait of Malacca, that the coastal states are all state parties to UNCLOS. And if that's the case, then they are subject to the regime UNCLOS sets out for international straits, which is known as transit passage. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that's different about the Strait of Hormuz is that Iran never ratified the UNCLOS treaty. Iran did sign the treaty, but to actually become a state party, you have to ratify it.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe Iran signed in 1982 when the treaty was opened up for signatory and has never ratified it since then. And a big reason why it didn't ratify UNCLOS was because it didn't accept this transit passage regime for international straits. UNCLOS created this new regime for international mm-hmm. straits. Before UNCLOS, there had been a different regime known as innocent passage. The reason Iran didn't like transit passage is because transit passage substantially reduced its ability to regulate the strait for purposes of security. Innocent passage gives states greater regulatory authority within international straits. It also allows states to actually charge for specific services. So fees for specific services rendered mm-hmm. to ships. That wasn't I don't think that was the reason Iran initially did not like the transit passage regime, but certainly it's asserting its right to do this now. Now, why does Iran say that the Strait of Hormuz is Iran's territorial waters? Part of it is, roughly half of it is. So mm-hmm. it's made up, the Strait of Hormuz is made up exclusively of the territorial waters of Oman and Iran. But, you know, international straits are, there are a number of international straits that are made up of the territorial waters of states. The point of UNCLOS, the point of that transit passage regime was actually to ensure that despite the fact that now there were all these straits, and I'll explain in a second why I said now, now there were all these straits that actually were composed of the territorial seas of states. Transit passage was developed in order to curb the innocent passage rights that foreign states would typically have in the territorial seas of states. So when you're in territorial waters of a state, it's innocent passage that governs. And that had been applied to these states in the to the international straits as well. And the problem became even worse once the territorial seas of these states expanded. So what UNCLOS did was take what had been a 3 nautical mile territorial sea and make it 12 nautical miles. Mm. When maritime powers agreed to that under UNCLOS, they said, okay, we'll agree to that, but we now need a special regime for international straits. Because now the territorial seas of states has increased in distance, we are going to have far more international straits that are going to be exclusively composed of the territorial sea. There will be no high seas passage, for example, in the Strait of Hormuz, because now we have 12 nautical miles on both sides. On one side, Oman, on one side, Iran.
I'm sorry, real briefly, high seas passage, could you define that real quickly again?
High seas, it's freedom of the seas.
Any ship can go through.
Any ship can go through.
Including warships?
Including warships, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, warships can actually go through an innocent passage as well.
Right.
Although it gets a little, we can talk about situations where they wouldn't have the right to pass through according
right.
to innocent passage, especially international straits. So basically, this is the debate. This is the conversation. Many states, including the United States, are saying transit passage applies to the Strait of Hormuz. It's not innocent passage. It's transit passage. Iran is saying, no. We never ratified UNCLOS. We're not a state party. we're subject to the older customary international rule of innocent passage. That's what applies, at least in our territorial waters in the Strait of Hormuz. Because innocent passage applies, we have greater regulatory rights in the Strait, and we can charge fees for specific services rendered to ships. That's the debate. And, you know, whether or not everything Iran has done or will do actually complies with innocent passage, I think that's a question. But the point that the article I wrote in The Nation was trying to make, and that I've been, like, you know, exhausting myself trying to make over the last few weeks, is that this is not, Iran has a legal basis for claiming regulatory authority over the Strait, for saying that, you know, ships need to, you know, comply with its particular rules that it's been developing, that they need authorization from Iran before passing through, you know, that, you know, there may be fees that will be charged or have been charged. Like, there is a legal basis for this. This is not just Iran completely, you know, ripping up international law, saying we're going to do whatever we want. No. This is a position Iran has taken broadly, that innocent passage applies to the Strait of Hormuz, for decades. Going back to the Shah's government, the UNCLOS treaty began to be negotiated in 1973. The Islamic Republic of Iran did not come to power until 1979. For several years before that transition, the Iranian government had consistently taken the position that innocent passage should apply to international straits. They didn't win, ultimately, during the negotiation, but, you know, they chose not to ratify the treaty, and they don't have to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so Iran, these are the grounds that Iran has to be able to actually claim legally the authority to do the kinds of things it's been describing in the Strait of Hormuz.
Right. So, I mean, I have a bunch of questions here, but the first one is, well, we should talk about what Oman's position is on this, because Oman is the other party to it.
Right.
And it seems like their position on it, Oman, which has always tried to maintain as neutral a stance as possible, as opposed to all the other Gulf states, and has done so successfully until Trump threatened to bomb them. So that's one question. The other question is, if you know, because it's been hard to get, do the ships traveling through the Strait, do they have to at some point or other pass through what would be Iranian territorial waters? Or are there lanes that would allow them to go much closer to Oman? Not that Iran would probably object to that, but I'm just wondering, you know, since we're talking about terminology here and sort of the law side of it.
Yeah, I mean, so when I last looked at this, my understanding was that, so there is a shipping route lane that was agreed to by Oman and Iran, you know, a while ago, that was effectively the shipping lanes for the Strait of Hormuz. I believe they pass through Omani waters, I believe. At least that's what I saw, but I didn't, you know, dig down too much into it. So, you know, don't quote me on this. Mm-hmm. Because at the same time, my understanding is also that the deeper waters in the Strait of Hormuz are actually on the Iranian side.
Yes.
So that's part of why I was like, when I looked into this, I was like, huh. The shipping routes seem to be in Omani waters, but at the same time, like, the deep waters are on the Iranian side. So certainly for deeper tankers, it would seem that the Iranian side would be a necessity for them to pass through. Mm-hmm. If these ships are passing through Oman's waters, right, Iran does not have the ability to regulate Oman's territorial waters. That's not something Iran can do. So as I said, you know, there's a question mark as to, you know, whether or not what Iran is actually doing complies with what it has the legal authority to do in the Strait under the innocent passage regime. If what Iran is doing is regulating ships passing through Omani territorial waters without the consent of Oman,
right,
then we have a problem. But assuming these ships are going through, I mean, as I mentioned, there's this contiguous zone. Mm-hmm. So,
right,
you know, And then we get into questions of like the, so part of the challenge with Iran and its different maritime zones is that Iran's maritime zones are locked. And when I say locked, I mean they are in close proximity to the maritime zones of like seven other countries, right? Mm-hmm. Like in the Persian Gulf. And so because of this, Iran has had to delimit, it's had to mark, right, its zones in ways that actually limit them a bit more than they would normally be, because the on the other side, they have another state, right? So mm-hmm. Iran has entered into bilateral agreements with Oman, with okay. most of the Gulf states, limiting these sorts of zones, right? So basically, like, as long as Iran is regulating within its territorial sea or its contiguous zone or its exclusive economic zone, right, it can do, it has authority there, right? But mm-hmm. as soon as it jumps into the maritime zones of another state, right, Iran loses its ability to regulate in any kind of way unless it has some kind of agreement with that other state. What is Oman's position in all of this? Mm-hmm. I mean, when Oman signed UNCLOS, Oman has also ratified UNCLOS. So
right.
Oman is subject to the transit passage regime that UNCLOS sets out. It actually made an interesting statement about the transit passage concept. It basically said that transit passage doesn't prevent a coastal state from taking, you know, measures that might be necessary to protect its security. And transit passage does actually leave room for that. I mean, it's more of a restrictive regulatory regime than innocent passage, but it does leave room for that. So you could just read the signing statement as being consistent with transit passage, but it's also notable, right, that Oman decides to make this point upon signing the treaty. So
does that have legal weight if there's any debate, you know, any kind of confrontation in a court that they made sure to have that statement on the record when they signed it?
Well, it shows that they interpret transit passage in a particular kind of way, you know? So yeah, right. it's not irrelevant at all. Yeah. And it might suggest, along with some sort of statements that Oman has made recently, that they may be open to some kind of regulatory regime in the strait, like in collaboration with Iran. Because Iran has been working, clearly has been working with Oman, is trying to work with Oman. Iran has very good relationships with Oman. Right. There's no way Iran, it gets confusing, Iran would be willing to blow that up, you know, so to speak. You know, like that relationship has existed for a very long time and it's been very beneficial for both states. So Iran is undoubtedly working with Oman. And Oman has started to make statements along the lines of, you know, we want to ensure the safety, the safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz. You know, like obviously that's a vague term. But given the fact that Oman believes it is very consistent with transit passage to take measures to ensure security and safety under a transit passage regime, it's possible they could get to a point where they're like, yeah, this regulation, we can regulate this more robustly than we have been. Whether or not they will themselves charge fees or be comfortable with Iran charging fees, I don't know, but they do seem to be open to working with Iran to develop a more robust regulatory regime for the Strait of Hormuz within the transit passage regime that they're subject to.
Right. And I read that Qatar very recently, in the last couple of days, kind of floated that they might be willing for a limited period of time. It's definitely a shift.
It was interesting.
It was totally
interesting. A temporary, that they'd be open to the temporary charging of fees. And the Iranians have gotten better. Again, it's, you know, especially the early stuff, a lot of it was coming out secondhand, third hand. It was hard to know, you know, were the Iranians themselves using the toll booth concept, you know, because you can't, even under innocent passage, you can't have a toll booth. You right. can't just charge ships for passing through. You can only charge them for specific services rendered to the ship, like environmental services, safety and security-based services, these sorts of things. Right. But the toll booth, toll stuff was getting thrown around a lot. But recently, the spokesperson for the Iranian Foreign Ministry actually explicitly made the point, this is not a toll. Do mm-hmm. not call it a toll. Mm-hmm. These are fees. I believe he said these are fees that would be charged for environmental reasons.
Right, right.
Which you can conceivably do under the innocent passage regime. So it's very interesting.
What if someone like the IRI just changed their mind about that? Like, we're now charging toll. What would be the international community response?
What would they do? I mean, yeah. they're already not happy. I think a lot of members of the international community are not yeah. happy because obviously they are suffering greatly from an economic standpoint as a result of what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz. You know, if the, you know, Iranian government were to come out and say, yep, we're just charging for toll. It's just a toll booth. It's just for passage. Yeah, that would, from an international law standpoint, I don't know.
I think what it'd be politically,
would be. I don't think there would be.
It'd be politically problematic too for Iran. I mean, Iran gains, you know, political leverage to a degree and in the area and beyond by being the victim of this war. And if yeah. they're suddenly being the ones who are aggressively right. throwing international right. law to the side,
yeah,
then,
exactly.
right? Yeah, that's the
right.
way I see it.
Then they
yeah.
look bad. And yeah. the thing is, like, you know, what's really from a, since we're on a nerdy podcast here, what's really interesting from a nerdy perspective, especially on all of this, is that, you know, like thinking, you know, back to the sort of law of the sea and mm-hmm. the ways in which it's developed, especially since World War II, like the third world developing states have worked really hard to try and make the law of the sea work for them, mm-hmm. right? They've tried to, they're the ones that push this notion of the exclusive economic zone, as I mentioned before, even though they didn't ultimately benefit from it. They're the ones that pushed for a 12 nautical mile territorial mm-hmm. sea so they could have more sovereignty. Countries like the United States didn't want a 12-mile nautical sea, 12 nautical miles sea. That's, you know, part of the negotiation at UNCLOS that I mentioned earlier around international straits.
Were they able to maintain this? Was it because the Soviet Union still had power then? Interesting.
The Soviet Union was also a maritime power. You know, it's right. the global south. It's the okay. G77. It's Latin America in particular that really led the way on a lot of this.
Interesting.
Really pushing in a coordinated way, first regionally, first sub-regionally, then regionally, and then more broadly to shift the discourse on a lot of these concepts.
That's kind of Greg Grandin's, one of his main points from his last book. Yeah, it's just kind of interesting. Yeah, yeah.
Latin America is fascinating. Yeah. They've done a lot of like really cool stuff in a variety of different areas. But when you look at, for example, how the third world was able to achieve these gains, not just in the area of like the law of the sea, but in other areas as well where the third world has really made its mark in international law, taken it back from, you know, Western imperial colonial powers that had developed modern international law to suit their needs, right? Mm-hmm. The third world did that sometimes unilaterally, but usually and ultimately through collaborating with one another, through working together, through convincing one another, right? Mm-hmm. Now, certainly Iran and the Strait of Hormuz has military force, right? Like to mm-hmm. be able to kind of, you know, make its way the only way, right? It has that. But at the same time, Iran is not a massive military power, right? Like mm-hmm. it cannot, you know, hold off the entire world. And, you know, there have been efforts at the Security Council to basically get the entire world on yes. board to use military power against Iran to open the Strait of Hormuz. You know, so Iran can't ultimately just rely on its military power to enforce its will the way the United States can, right? The United right. States can break international law and then just use its force, economic, military, to just leave other countries without an option but to comply. Iran right. can't really do that. So ultimately, what Iran needs and what Iran seems to be doing is working with other states. to get other states on board with this sort of new approach it wants to take.
Right.
Relatively new approach. And that's the way Iran, if Iran is able to succeed there, then Iran will actually be able to make this a meaningful regime in the Strait of Hormuz. And who knows, potentially influence other states to make, you know, these kinds of claims as well, which is one of the things that the United States is obviously worried about, that there will be this sort of like domino effect, you know, that other states will now start charging fees for, you know, special services or whatever through international straits. Although, and that's the last thing I'll say, because I know you want to interject, even if that were to happen, the world is not going to end, right? The Panama Canal charges fees. The Suez Canal charges fees. They're not international straits, but they're still really important choke points. The Bosphorus and Dardanelles under the Montreux Convention, fees are charged. It's not the end of the world, right? If this ends up becoming something more common, you know, like these companies are making massive profits off of these oils without these fees, you know? So, you know, like it's, if anything, all it does is empower coastal states a little bit more and actually allow them to generate some revenue from the maintenance of these straits, which is not cost free.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think for Trump specifically, and then, you know, his administration and the military and so on, the main problem specifically to this strait, and I'm sure it applies to some others, but the main problem specifically to this one is if there is any fee structure agreed upon that involves money going to the Iranian government, it means that Trump has agreed to do what he attacked Biden and Obama doing. He's made a new regime that funnels money to Iran, which goes right to making nuclear bombs aimed at Israel and terrorists aimed at the West. I mean, I'm obviously using their language. And so it's a giant political loss. So it's this is as much of a hard, bitter pill for Trump to swallow as formalizing the defeat, you know, in any kind of peace deal that needs to be formalized.
No, you're right. You're right.
Let's also talk about the Bab al-Mandab Strait off the southwestern coast of Yemen, another one of these very strategic and narrow waterways through which all kinds of vital shipping traffic, global shipping traffic goes through. And of course, you know, last year and even a bit the year before, Ansarallah, the Houthis of Yemen, shut it down, basically imposed a kind of selective blockade over Israel's genocide in Palestine, and were firing missiles on shipping that they deemed, you know, hostile or basically allied with Israel, helping Israel, and also got into, you know, basically a naval war with the U.S., eventually chased them out. But they were firing missiles on shipping in the Red Sea, Gulf of Aden. And, you know, there's talk of this maybe happening again.
Yeah, I mean, talking very broadly, right, about Yemen attacking, an armed attack against merchant vessels going through the strait. I mean, broadly speaking, I mean, you know, there are very specific circumstances under which you can attack a merchant ship. And certainly if it's a neutral merchant ship, I mean, the limitations are even greater. So, you know, like certainly, you know, Yemen was, you know, in a kind of state of war with Israel. You know, if these were Israeli merchant ships, then that's a different issue. You know, potentially there can be a basis to attack those ships. But if these are neutral ships going through the Strait of the Bab al-Mandab, even in a time of war, you can't, you can't attack them. You can't target them.
Right.
Unless they've become military objectives, which means, like, for example, that they're making an effective contribution to Israel's war against you, for example.
Right.
You know, so you can't just willy-nilly bomb merchant vessels, neutral merchant vessels going through, you know, an international strait, your territorial waters even.
So that was, in a sense, a legal rationale as well as a political justification for, you know, how and why they were attacking the Houthis.
You're saying
shipping.
For the Yemenis?
The Houthi Yemenis, yeah.
I mean, like I said, I think without knowing a little bit more about the specific instances, right? Like what ships were they? Were they enemy merchant ships or were they neutral merchant ships? It's hard to really give a definitive legal answer. But broadly speaking, you cannot attack merchant vessels, enemy or otherwise, unless they've basically become a military objective of some kind. Now, the ways in which merchant vessels become targetable under the laws of war is a bit broader than how we normally think about targeting civilian objects that become military objects. But, you know, the broad point, right, is that like a time of war does not give you the authority to attack civilian objectives. That's a basic principle of international humanitarian law. You cannot target civilians or civilian objectives. And that applies to merchant vessels.
The U.S. Navy fired a Hellfire missile at the Iranian oil tanker yesterday in the Gulf of Oman, that presumably was a violation of international law. And presumably the American blockade is as well a violation.
The American blockade is 100% a violation of international law because it's a continuation of the unlawful U.S. war that started on February 28th. So it's a continuation of that war. Blockades are, very prototypical examples of uses of force, even though you don't necessarily need to, quote unquote, use the force, right? They are considered uses of force. And when launched illegally are acts of aggression. So the blockade is unlawful. It's considered an act of aggression under international law. Now, that's the situation of the blockade. Now, what happens during the blockade is a different issue. So you can have like an illegal war, for example, but then like the illegal war could technically be conducted legally as long as you, which is a little weird concept. I mean, and we could get into whether or not, like, you know, there's some who argue that, you know, if the entire war is illegal, that adds a layer of illegality onto everything that happens during the war. But, you know, the laws that govern the initial use of force are separate from the laws that govern the actual regulation of that use of force once it's been used the first time. And the same thing goes for a naval blockade. So there are specific rules that govern whether or not the naval blockade, once it's been instituted, is actually being implemented lawfully. So whether or not, so the Iranian oil vessel is an enemy merchant ship. So there are enemy merchant ships are more targetable than neutral merchant ships.
Okay.
So, and one of the reasons you can, for example, target an enemy merchant ship is where that merchant ship is trying to run a blockade, right? So if there's a blockade and you warn them to stop and they don't stop, then you can actually attack them.
I wonder if, because I'm pretty sure Iran did not publicly take credit for hitting that the tanker in Iraq or in an Iraqi port. That I mentioned, which was part of the tit for tat that just happened in the last 24 hours. I think they did not take credit for that publicly, and they've done this at different times, but they did openly take credit for hitting the Fifth Fleet headquarters, or at least targeting the Fifth Fleet headquarters in Bahrain, and because that would be a military target, right? And targets in Kuwait, which were military targets or dual use. But that I guess would explain it. Would Iran have the right? I guess it depends how they would rationalize it then, right? Like, would they have the right to have hit
it does.
That? Okay.
Right. So I mean, so there are two ways of thinking about it. One is, is there an ongoing armed conflict between Iran, Bahrain, and Kuwait? So based on, the things have happened since February 28th, effectively, or did that armed conflict end? And was this an initial use of force?
I see.
If this was an initial use of force, then the question will become, was the territory of Bahrain or Kuwait used with their knowledge and permission to engage in an armed attack against Iran, in an unlawful armed attack against Iran? If so, then under sort of the laws that govern the use of force, Iran would have a right to self-defense against those mm-hmm. states. If okay. there is an ongoing armed conflict between these states, you know, there's still arguably there's still certainly a requirement to determine whether or not the use of armed force is necessary. And if it's then necessary, that it's directed at military objectives and that the use of force is proportionate so that, like, you know, mm-hmm. any incidental harm to civilians or civilian objectives is not greater than the sort of military goal of the attack. Mm-hmm. So, you know, without knowing more, it's hard to say whether or not what Iran did in Bahrain and Kuwait over the last day is lawful. Mm-hmm. Certainly the targeting of an airport, regardless of whether or not Iran can use the force, does raise question marks.
Well, the U.S. uses that airport as well, apparently.
Right. So that would make it potentially dual use.
Yes.
But then the question becomes, is it necessary to target that airport? So the strongest question around necessity, which needs to be asked no matter what, whether or not this is an ongoing armed conflict or this is a first use of force, you know, is like, you know, do you need, is it necessary to target this airport? Meaning, you know, again, providing the strong argument, for example, did the attack that was initiated against you come from this airport? Mm-hmm. If it did, then that bolsters the necessity argument for Iran and helps to, you know, justify its attack against the airport. But again, the attack still needs to be proportionate. This is also, this is a civilian airport as well, right? Even if it's a quote unquote dual use space, there are civilians there, you know? So any attack that you launch needs to be take into consideration questions of proportionality, questions of humanity, which usually involves some kind of warning. So, you know, I don't have a clear answer as to whether or not what Iran did in Bahrain and Kuwait over the last day is lawful or not without knowing again, you know, like, I think probably you could argue that there's an armed conflict between these three entities. But still, was it necessary for Iran to respond in this way?
Which will bring us to the larger question of you know, international law and the use of it. But before we get there, I just want to at least get one. I have a lot of questions, but I don't want to get too hung up on all this. So at least one, though. You have, you know, you have this graph in your piece, on your Substack, on your piece that's called Can Iran Regulate from Coast to Coast in the Strait of Hormuz? And I remember when the Iranians first posted this. So it's, you know, in purple, it shows the actual Strait of Hormuz, I guess as is generally recognized, which is very narrow, you know, and it's shaped kind of like a light bulb going from Oman up to, you know, including Hormuz Island, Larak, up to the Iranian coast. And then Iran said, no, from now on, we decree or we've decided that this is really the, under Iranian oversight, or this is the Strait of Hormuz. And it goes from the Iranian coast sort of on the west side inside the Persian Gulf. It goes from the coast actually of Keshem, which the U.S. just attacked. So, but that, of course, is Iranian territory. Keshem to both of these go to United Arab Emirates territory, not to this narrow Omani exclave. So to al-Quwain on the west side. And on the east side in the Gulf of Oman, and I think this is at least as significant, it includes Fujairah, which is a key United Arab Emirates port where they were hoping to be able to get all of their resources, goods, everything out of in case the straits closed. But it now is part of the strait as defined by Iran. So I guess my question is, you know, where did they come up with this, or what does this even mean that they've decided that? And you know, which I guess, I mean, we're learning really how important war is to establishing rules, like new realities.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. War has been an important inflection point historically in terms of the development of international law and international, like, multilateral institutions. So yeah, this is, you know, even if this war is technically just between a handful of states and feels regional. I mean, the global implications, right, not just from an economic standpoint, but also potentially from a legal standpoint, are enormous. I mean, so so this was issued by the Persian Gulf Strait Authority, which has just been established, but of course has its own X handle. And they posted this image on their X page. And it says that transit through this area that you just described for, quote, purposes of passing through the Hormuz Strait requires coordination with and authorization from the Persian Gulf Strait Authority. So importantly, the purpose of passage needs to be to go through the Hormuz Strait, which, you know, is likely, right? In this area, most likely ships in this area aren't just like hanging out, you know, they're like probably passing through the strait. So as I mentioned in the post on Substack, you know, I don't want to repeat what I just went over. Like, it really all depends on the different maritime zones, what Iran can do in this area, right? Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned earlier, once Iran is in the maritime zones of Oman or the UAE, it can't do anything. Like, forget about it. Like, game over, right? So if that's what this is, like, forget about it. Like, and it looks like probably part of it is at least that, right? Like, because it's going all the way to the coast of Oman and the UAE. But as I also mentioned, like, Iran isn't actually just limited to the territorial waters of the Strait of Hormuz in terms of its regulatory abilities, right? Like, it has regulatory authority in its contiguous zone. It has regulatory authority in its exclusive economic zone, right?
Right.
So can it regulate in this entire area without the consent of these other states?
Right.
I have, like, no
way. So this goes back to our discussion that we've already basically had.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, but can it regulate in more than just that purple area? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right, yeah, and there's also a couple of islands here. I don't know how much this plays into it, which are, which Iran
disputed.
Sees, right, back in 1971 when the Trucial States turned into the independent United Arab Emirates and freed from Britain, or went independent from Britain, I would say, which would be the Lesser Tomb, the Greater Tomb, and Abu Musa, which would presumably expand their, all these zones that we've talked of, territorial waters, contiguous, and so on, right? Because it's
yeah,
Iranian.
So Iran claims those islands and controls those islands. And, you know, Iran has, you know, in my view, a far longer and more established historical claim to those islands than the UAE does. If those islands are considered Iranian territory, then that does expand its maritime zones. Iran has not actually... as I mentioned, a bilateral agreement, a series of bilateral agreements with Oman. It has agreements with a number of other Persian Gulf states, but it, in terms of setting the maritime delimitation zones, since the zones overlap in the Persian Gulf, it doesn't actually have one with the Emirates. They negotiated a treaty. Iran actually quickly ratified that treaty in the 70s, but the Emirates didn't. And they likely didn't because of the dispute over these islands. Mm-hmm. So the sort of delimitation with the UAE has not been sort of bilaterally set, but Iran does have a domestic law that relates to all this stuff and that just sort of sets out the way it will delimit the zone when there's no agreement with its neighbors. So, but, you know, it's going to delimit the zone. The exclusive economic zone is really what matters here in such a way that is going to obviously include those islands.
Right. So then this brings us back to the question we've kind of been dancing around, which is how much does international law really matter? And if you've gone into this some in your own writings, that a lot of international law, you know, regarding territorial waters, right of trans, all this, a lot of it was developed really by the imperial powers, Western imperial powers, in the 18th and 19th century. And, you know, the strong are always going to make generally international laws to codify their position versus the weak that, you know, that they want to take resources from and so on. They want to kind of keep that structure in place. And that is at least part of the purpose of the law. Mm-hmm. And you know, the law, though, at times, even as set up by the Western powers to codify their power, it can and has been a problem for them because they violate their own laws when it's no longer convenient. And we've seen this most stark. I mean, this, you know, we could go back to many examples, the Iraq War and so on. But mm-hmm. certainly just in the last few years, I think it's just been shoved in our faces in a way that's just really disconcerting and really like has really kind of broken the whole international liberal order, such as it even existed, or people's sense of it or belief in it. You know, of course, the genocide, the ongoing genocide in Palestine, mm-hmm. and again, you know, Trump and, I mean, the U.S. and Israel launching an illegal war of aggression, the supreme crime, according to the Nuremberg trials, according to Robert Jackson, mm-hmm. that all other crimes come out of, including genocide and, and then, of course, assassinating a head of state. That hasn't been done, mm-hmm. At least in the post-war era. That openly, I mean, it's been done, but you don't do it openly mm-hmm. and admit it. So, right? And then, so like, you're a professor of it. Yeah. You're a professor of international law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, like, I don't know, how has this affected your understanding of international mm-hmm. law and how you're thinking about it? And, you know, where do you think it goes from here?
Yeah, this is a question that, you know, I've obviously been thinking about for a long time and mm-hmm. get asked about. And I don't know if I have a great answer. What I know, though, is that I hear the third world, I hear third world states crying out for international law to be respected.
Right.
I hear, you know, like, I think he was the deputy foreign minister for Iran, say that Iran demands to be treated as an equal under international law. Mm-hmm. Iran is not going to give up the rights that it is entitled to under international law. You know, I hear the Palestinians, right? I hear the state of Palestine, whether you like them or not, desperately crying out for international law to be respected, doing, you know, everything it can to use international legal institutions to try and not just prevent what's happening, because, you know, prevention is hard, but at least to create the foundations for accountability. Mm-hmm. And if even that can't be achieved, like the legal, moral, and ethical record for ensuring that what was done and what is being done to the Palestinians remains a deep, deep stain on the Western world mm-hmm. for certainly my lifetime, if not for generations to come. Mm-hmm. International law is a tool, right? Like mm-hmm. so many other parts of the law, right? Like domestic law is a tool, right? Mm-hmm. That also is not perfectly enforced by any stretch of the imagination, that often is weaponized politically, mm-hmm. Under which many rich and powerful people are often not held accountable. I mean, just look at, you know, the efforts at accountability for the Bush administration or other U.S. government officials in the United States over the last few decades. There's been nothing, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying the U.S. law is, you know, in any way, shape, or form, you know, not flawed. It obviously is, but it shares the same flaws international law has. But it's not, in my view, serving those who are weaker and marginalized by eliminating it altogether, right? Instead, mm-hmm. what we ought to do and what we see Iran doing right now in the Strait of Hormuz and more broadly is making international law work for it. And not just for it, but for other states. Mm-hmm. Iran has said it's not just fighting for itself. It's fighting for the global South. From a military standpoint, that's certainly true. To prevent, you know, the United States and Israel from continuing to completely just eviscerate the mm-hmm. basic fundamental principles of international law, as you mentioned, the prohibition on the crime of aggression, the prohibition on the use of force, the prohibition on armed attack. Iran is fighting militarily for those prohibitions to be respected, but it's also fighting, you know, legally in terms of the argument that it deploys, in terms of the, you know, non-kinetic moves it's making in the Strait of Hormuz in particular, to also, you know, for the sake of the broader Global South community, potentially provide them with tools to assert their own sovereignty over international straits. You know, like, so we see in this moment these victims, right, of these abridgments, of these violations of international law, not saying international law is irrelevant, not saying to hell with international law, and also we're just going to do whatever we want. We see them actually clinging to international law, reinforcing the importance of international law, and I would say actually abiding by international law. You know, like, we can talk about, you know, some of these attacks on the Gulf states, not just the ones that happened over the last day, but the ones that Iran was engaging in before as well. Mm-hmm. Those attacks, first of all, Iran has, I think, made reasonable claims that at least some of these states were directly involved by allowing the use of their territory by the United States and Israel to launch attacks against Iran, that they were directly involved in these armed attacks, that they were effectively also engaging in acts of aggression. And reporting has suggested that perhaps some of these states were themselves firing at Iran.
Yep.
So, you know, like, and when Iran responded, you know, and we've seen, like, you know, again, not the most massive military power, certainly don't have the same kinds of weapons that these Gulf states do, but they have developed relatively sophisticated weaponry. They're able to target things, right? Like, precisely.
Yes.
You did not see anywhere, nowhere near the level of attack against civilians or civilian objects by Iran. Nowhere near that. Yes. Not even in Israel. You know, whereas when you look at the level of attack against civilians and civilian objects in Iran, that's, you see systematic patterns. You do not see systematic patterns by any stretch of the imagination in the Iranian attacks against the Gulf states. Were there situations where civilian objects were attacked? Yeah, maybe. Like, that didn't become dual use or something. Yeah, potentially. But you did not see that same kind of systematic targeting of civilians. Yes. You know, again, in the Strait of Hormuz, Iran has, like, very clearly been leveraging international law, right? So in this moment where Iran could just be like, well, who cares? Game, you know, the jig is up. We're being attacked in a clearly unlawful war. We're going to do whatever we want. It's not doing that. And you could say, okay, strategically, it couldn't really do that. It's not the United States. It can't really do that. Yeah, maybe. But at the same time, like, I don't think we should discount the degree to which Iran sees compliance with international law as being in its interests.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Right. And the maintenance of the international legal system as being in its interests, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, enforcement is a massive problem. The United Nations, it sucks. I don't know if I can say that word. It's not a bad word, right?
You can say it, yes.
You know?
You can use even dirtier words if you want, but yes.
Oh, amazing. The United Nations is shit, you know? It's shit, you know? But an international law also has, you know, big problems in a lot of different areas and doctrines. But we are, what would be sad to me, what would be so sad to me is in this moment over the last several decades where the Global South has now emerged, right? We have something like 134 members of the G77. The G77 was established in 1964 as sort of like the third world, the sort of organizing entity for like third world states. We have the BRICS now, which also kind of acts like that, right? As the Global South is getting more and more organized, and certainly there's been ebbs and flows, and like, you know, the end of the Cold War was not great for third world solidarity, but nevertheless, we still have this, right? We still have the third world, you know, in some sense, uniting around different kinds of issues, like, for example, Gaza, you know, and making and trying to use, and in some ways successfully using international law to make, to really create gains for the Global South. If it's in this moment that we say, oh, international law doesn't matter, forget about it, you know who wins? The United States wins. Israel wins.
Yes,
these countries that are actively saying, well, we don't need this. It doesn't serve our interests. So let's throw it aside. Might makes right. That doesn't serve the Global South. That serves you know, that serves those developed Western states.
Yeah, I was just thinking there is a sense that there are things you don't do. And
yeah. There are these broad principles, right? And these, mm-hmm. we'll call it morality, call it whatever you want. Like, you know, you don't need international law to tell you that like a genocide is wrong. You know, like you don't need that, right? Yeah. But what international law does, it gives us a stable foundation, one that is, you know, supposedly objective,
right.
supposedly consistent, applied across the board. I mean, this is what
supposedly
it's supposed to be, right?
Supposedly consensual, too, between
supposedly
all the parties.
Consensual, yeah. exactly. Yeah. You know, like, and it, so it gives you, it bolsters, right, those principles, you yeah. know? It takes them out of, you know, potentially like the religious arena where yes. we can dispute, you know, what is a moral principle, it isn't to a space that has, you know, quote unquote, a bit more objectivity to it.
But, you know, one thing that I just find so glaring about this war in the discourse in America, let's say, and probably all of the West, in the media and so on, in the, you know, in the New York Times, which is really the kind of the mirror to what power is thinking and how it frames things, even though they're against this war, I just never see ever them talking about how it's illegal, how the war, the war that was launched is illegal, and that the assassination yeah. never. Maybe they might question the legality of the war. I can't recall seeing it, but they might. But they never talk at all about how illegal and unusual it is that we assassinated openly a head of state. Has it always been like this where kind of establishment, serious, the people for whom law matters a lot, they're always pontificating about law, international law, right. domestic law, rule of law is one of their big yeah. mantras. And it's just, I actually don't think it crosses their mind as mm-hmm. a relevant issue. What does that say, though, that A, the U.S. is... It seems worse, you know, very much open. Well, it is. It doesn't seem. It is. I mean, Trump ran on screw international law. You know,
yeah.
International law is what we say because we're powerful. That this mm-hmm. is out in the open, and that that there's mm-hmm. no countervailing at the kind of elite ruling class level. There's no countervailing kind of pushback to stick yeah. to international law on the most yeah. important thing, which is the war we're in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, even taking it beyond the United States, I mean, yeah. looking at the response from, like, you know, like the Western, yeah. the Europeans, the yeah. Canadians, the Australians, I mean, like, to the extent that there was, you know, any pushback, it was so mild. I mean, with the exception of, like, you know, the Prime Minister of Spain, you know, to a lesser extent, Ireland, maybe Slovenia, you know, they've also been good, you know, relatively good on, you know, speaking out against the genocide as well. You know, the vast majority of the Western Europe, like, didn't really say anything. I mean, the Chancellor of Germany, Friedrich Merz, said Iran doesn't deserve the protections of international law. Like, we're back to, like,
yes,
the 19th
yes.
century, 20th century, when it's like, oh, international law only has rights for us.
Yes.
We're the only ones protected by international law. The rest of the world, no, they're uncivilized. They don't actually, international law doesn't apply to them. It's right. just amongst ourselves. You know, literally came out and said that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or Mark Carney, who was like, maybe it's illegal, but it's good.
Yeah.
You know, like, what yeah. is this? You know, like, and then, you know, 3 months before he had been lauded at Davos for making yes. the speech about yeah. like how we can't depend on the United States anymore and international yeah. law matters, right? Like in the context of Greenland or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, like that's when it suddenly matters, when it like is close to home. So yeah, I mean, when I think about, for example, the Iraq war, like listen, the global South is screaming its head off. So like, yes. I don't mean to ignore them because like, and they are the vast majority of the world, you know, and like, in some sense, like, let's stop caring, you know, about mm-hmm. what the Western Europeans do. If anything, they've just made themselves completely irrelevant and showed themselves to be the complete hypocrites mm-hmm. That, you know, they frankly have long been first during the genocide and now as a result of the Iran war. But you know, but still, they're powerful and they matter.
Yes.
And exactly. During the Iraq War, there was such strong pushback, you know, from Europe. Yeah. Not obviously from the UK, but from the French, from the Germans, you know, and it's gone. Yep. It's gone, you know. And meanwhile, they're clutching their pearls about Ukraine and Russia, which is, you know, I'm not suggesting that that's not a serious issue. Ukraine's obviously was aggressed on too quite seriously. But, you know, it's like, I don't know if it's the Ukraine situation that has made them crazy or if it's just like they're also just, you know, no longer interested in pretending that there's any kind of equity when it comes to the international legal system. But no, it has been shocking. It has been shocking. But again, more reason to defend and protect international law because if these are the actors that are saying, that are ignoring it or saying it doesn't matter, then that makes international law that much more valuable because those are the actors who have a lot of power, right? Those are the actors that can actually, you know, trample on the rest of the world and do serious damage to the global South. The international law is not, I don't care whether or not it protects them, right? I care about it because I think it's a tool that can be used to protect the rest of the world that it was otherwise going to be at the mercy of these states, you know? But yeah, I'm absolutely, you know, my jaw has been on the floor for years.
Yeah, I imagine so. Well, I think on that happy note, we can end our great interview with you. And maybe we'd like to bring you on again another time soon to talk about, you have also a really fascinating, you've done some studies into this is actually not even unrelated at all. The Iranian death toll.
Estimating casualties and
how you
mess with that.
And how we've come to, like I saw Clarissa Ward, who, I mean, not that, you know, Clarissa Ward has always been problematic as a CNN war correspondent, but to see her, there were limits, I would say, even within her discourse. And I just saw her the other day saying, Iran murdered 40,000 protesters. Like, wow, even she's saying that now. Yeah. So it's kind of filtering down to what would be more like the centrist class. And that was kind of surprising. Yeah. So just so people know, if you look at Miriam's Substack, you'll see her really break down the evolution of the death toll number. And it's grim stuff, but as death tolls are, but death tolls are our propaganda, you know, either counting it, not counting it, undercounting it, overcounting it, and how it inflated from roughly 3,500 to maybe 6,000 or something to it had to go double digits higher and higher.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating how you did that. But that's for another episode. Thank you, John, Brendan, and our guest, Miriam Jamshidi, and to all of our subscribers as well. Thanks again. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.